Hey everyone, so good to be back blabbing away here after being sick. Happy to be back here. So happy to see my friends. And tonight we are going to talk about forgiveness. So just to reiterate, because we're a standalone meeting and we're not affiliated with Overeaters Anonymous or any other anonymous fellowship, even though most, if not all of us, attend a 12-step program, we're free to mention outside literature. So we do that sometimes. And I just wanted to say that before I do it tonight. So no one says, puts in the chat, Janet, you're breaking a tradition. We don't have any traditions here. We just, this started four people and I get together on a Zoom once a week and, you know, it grew, but it's as if you're all sitting in my living room. So grab your cup of coffee. Don't spill it on my rug, please. And talk about forgiveness. On page 66 of our big book, it tells us that resentments are fatal, right? That they lead to our demise because they cut us off from the sunlight of the spirit. And just imagine the visual, a plant being cut off from the sunlight. It would die. So too us when we're cut off from God. And the big book goes on and tells us how to get rid of resentments. And 2 weeks ago, we covered this session in depth, this part of the big book, how to get rid of resentments. But I wanted to share some, just like some random remarks on resolving resentments and entering into the state of forgiveness. So what do we do, right? There were 10 things that I've kind of mashed together from the big book mainly, and from a book by E. Stanley Jones. He was someone who the founders of AA used to study. When I was early in recovery, I said, I want to read the books that Dr. Bob and all those guys read. And so E. Stanley Jones was one of the authors, and a lot of these things are from his book, The Way to Power and Poise. So the first thing is to look at why we're angry. I mean, we all do the check marks, right? In our fourth step inventory, we check off what's affected. And really, isn't that generally the easiest column to fill out? But I think it deserves a little thought because according to E. Stanley Jones, the basis of most resentments is a touchy, unsurrendered self. Ouch, right? A touchy, unsurrendered self. The fact that I have a resentment shows that there's a self that's oversensitive because my will hasn't been 100% surrendered to God. And what he says is when surrendered to the will of God, we throw off resentments as healthy skin throws off disease germs. Unless there is a cut in the skin, the disease germs don't get in. So I started to ponder that, you know, around the third column in our resentment inventories. And I thought about a few things like self-esteem, right? One of the check marks that we have. That means I haven't surrendered to God the demand that others think about me in a certain way. If I did, it wouldn't bother me so much what anyone else said or thought of me. So whenever I check that column, self-esteem, I have to look at my part is probably I'm making what other people say or think about me my business, and it truly isn't. Ambitions. If I fully surrendered my career to God, for example, then it wouldn't matter so much if someone else got that promotion and not me, because I would know for certainty, like what it says on page 63 of the big book, we had a new employer, an employer with a capital E, meaning God, who provides all I need if I stay close to him and perform his work well. And I had an example of this. Years ago, I was working at a job and I was working at a law firm and I wouldn't join the bar association of my state because they had some values that I was very much opposed to. So I just said, I wouldn't join. And that was a deal breaker for my boss. So I got fired. But I got another job, except it paid, I think it was $15,000 a year less. But okay, happy, I got a job. Just at that time, and I mean just at that time, my parents called me and said, as part of their estate planning, they were giving me $1,500 a month. So $18,000 a year. So it's like, I realized God, a job was only one way that God could provide for me, right? I thought, oh, I'm screwed. I'm making 15 grand a year less. But remember, God's imagination is limitless. So he would say, yeah, maybe I close that door job as a way of getting you money, but I'm going to open another door. So I have to surrender my ambitions to God, knowing he will provide everything I need. Not always everything I want, but everything that he knows that I need. So, and we have to remember, step four comes after step three for a reason. I have the courage to do this often painful moral inventory and see where I'm not fully surrendered, because at this point, I believe in a God who is all loving, all powerful, and who cares about me. In other words, by this time, I know that God's got my back. And again, it's the same with my personal and sex relations and my security. If someone, you know, flirts with someone's boyfriend or husband, we'd say, you know, if God wants me in this relationship, it's not going to matter who flirts with them. You know, it's not going to matter who says or does what. So basically, if someone or something threatens me, I look to see where I haven't fully surrendered my right to something. Now I'm going to qualify this by saying this is the basis of most resentments. If someone has violence committed against her, let's be clear, I would never say, oh, your problem is lack of surrender. Okay, so we never want to say that to someone who's had violence committed against them. But generally, if it's my self-esteem, meaning my big fat pride, which by the way is Thursday's topic, that's been affected, you can bet there's something that needs to be surrendered more fully. How do I do that? God, please remove my pride and replace it with humility. And then I seek to practice humility. Number two, I realize that the other person is perhaps spiritually sick. Heavy emphasis on the word perhaps. I mean, in my illness days, I probably would have labeled Mother Teresa as spiritually sick if she said something I didn't like. But what about the times when someone just isn't as spiritually developed as I would like? I had a sponsor who showed me it's always helpful to look at their story. So for instance, I know somebody whose father yelled a lot, really yelled a lot, and worked nonstop around the clock, so wasn't home a lot. But if you heard about how her dad was brought up, her dad was physically abused by his father, who was an alcoholic and I think had trouble holding jobs. So this guy working two jobs and only yelling was major progress. And in God's eyes, he might actually be a saint. So we never should be too quick to judge. And it's helpful to remember there's a little bit of good in the worst of us and a little bit of bad in the best of us. And here's a modified prayer that I found helpful and pretty. Lord, this person is an infinitely precious child of yours and a spiritually developing person with flaws, just like I am. Please help me to relate with them with both truths in mind so that I can always love, always forgive, and if necessary, set appropriate boundaries. And Tricia just placed that in the chat if anyone wants to copy it. Also, since we're talking about realizing another person is perhaps spiritually sick, as the big book says, or as some of us like to say instead, spiritually developing, I think it's a good time to just mention forgiveness doesn't mean that I have to be in a relationship with someone who's so spiritually sick that it's unhealthy for me, that if they're abusive to me, if someone is abusive to me, I need to forgive them on the basis that they're spiritually sick, but I don't need to be in relationship. Forgiveness doesn't equal relationships. However, a lot of the time, once we're able to forgive, we want the relationship, but you know, we should not be in relationship with people who are abusive to us. Number three, we don't stop and say, okay, the other person is spiritually sick, I'll just pray for them. The book says we resolutely look for our part in the resentment. And our part is never just, I need to pray for them and see they're spiritually sick. Because it's too easy for me to get on a spiritual hilltop and say, I'll pray for that poor spiritually sick person down in the valley. We don't do that. But I really have to see my part. If someone was nasty to me, was I nasty first? If one of my kids isn't doing what they're supposed to, is my part that I was selfish and lazy in teaching them the right things? If I'm angry at how other people are acting, is my part, I think I have a right to control how others think, what they do, or what they say? I have no right to say who, you know, Uncle Joe should invite to his wedding, or who Cousin Sue, you know, should allow to come to the party that I'm also invited to, or not invited to. Sometimes my part is, I haven't set boundaries. Let's say one of my kids asks me for, is in college and says, Mom, I need extra money for food. And I give them money for food. And I see that, you know, they're spending it on video games and they do this month after month. My part is I need to set a boundary and say, no, you know, I'll give you a grocery debit card, but I'm not handing you $100 bills to spend on video games. Daniel, if you're listening, I am not talking about you. I'm just making up a for instance. Sometimes our part is we haven't had hard conversations out of fear of what the other person's reaction should be. And that's just control and idolatry and just plain old wrong. So I think about the woman who may be mad that, you know, the bedroom is so cold every night and is so angry at her husband. And then you say, well, did you ever tell him that it's too cold? She's like, no. Well, sometimes we need to have hard conversations. So many of our resentments would go away if we had hard conversations and realized that a lot of things are none of our business. And the best way that I deal with that, with this none of our business, is I picture myself in one of those lap pools swimming toward God. And I picture God like standing there at the end. And all these things like, you know, what classes my daughter is choosing. Lizzie, if you're listening, I don't care. Take whatever classes you want. Classes they're choosing, who they're dating, things like that. I physically picture myself putting them across the rope into the other lanes. They are none of my business. They will get me angry and distract me from looking at God. Let's say we do all this and we still have the resentment. Are there other things we can do? And there are. Number four, we have to make up our minds that in this world, we are not going to escape injustice and pain, right? The big book tells us about certain low spots and trials and tells us what to do when, not if, they say when trouble comes. The big book doesn't say we'll never have trouble. So if we believe that because we've surrendered our lives to God, our lives going forward will be pain-free, we will be guilty of that old enemy, expectations. And the big book says when trouble comes, we cheerfully capitalize on them as a chance for God to show his omnipotence. That means we do the right thing, trust God, and wait for the miracles. Okay, here's one. I hope my daughter isn't listening. She had this guy friend who I didn't really like that much. And when one time she said, oh, I'm going to go out with, you know, this guy. And I did not want her to. I did not think it was good. And I was like mad, like, why is she going to see him? And I just like said, okay, my job is to just keep my mouth shut. I said nothing, just let it go. And then she said, oh, you know what? I think I'm just going to go see my best friend who I adore. I'm going to go see my best friend instead. Now, did my keeping my mouth shut result in that? I don't know. But I do believe that if I had tried to take matters into my own hands, I would have tied God's hands. Number five, we can pray for those who harm us. E. Stanley Jones says, by praying for those who wrong us, the resentment is sterilized by the antiseptic of prayer. Isn't that pretty? By praying for those who wrong us, the resentment is sterilized by the antiseptic of prayer. He advises to pray first, as soon as we feel the first tinge of resentment. And this makes sense. If we try to do an inventory without bringing God into it, it's just psychology. And that doesn't work on people like us. Number six, we go beyond prayer. The big book says we ask God to show us how we can be helpful to the person who has hurt us. We can do actual physical good acts for those who hurt us. Can we bring in the garbage cans for the neighbor we don't like? I know that when my son was here, he's away in college now, and if he would irk me, Daniel, very seldom, but every now and then, I would sometimes, through gritted teeth, but still, if I was going out for a latte, I would say, Daniel, can I bring you back a latte? I would do something nice for him. If it was his job to empty the dishwasher, I would go alongside him and start doing it with him. The best example I can think of, it was in a movie, The End of the Spear, where there were a bunch of missionaries who went to some, it was some country in South America that was not very hospitable to missionaries. In fact, as soon as the guys got off the plane, this little prop plane, they killed them right then. As soon as they got off the plane, speared them to death. Their wives went back. And it just so happened at that time, the people there, there was a polio outbreak. And they sat there and they went and set up shop and ministered to the men who had polio, the very men who had killed their husbands. Remember in the chapter, The Family Afterwards, page 127, it says, we can help another person's crankiness disappear if we show love and spiritual understanding. Number seven, we can forgive because God has forgiven us. We can think about what God has done for us. Here's a quote from Ray Stedman in a book, Letters to a Troubled Church. Think of the thousand times a day God manifests his love and faithfulness to you. As you think of his love for you, a feeling of humble gratitude will spring up within you. As you experience gratitude to God for all he's done in your life, you will realize that the people around you need to be treated with love and patience, just as God has treated you. Since God has been so patient with you, how can you be critical and impatient toward others? God has patiently led you to a deeper understanding of his truth. He has waited for your lagging understanding and faltering faith to catch up. Given that, right? How should I respond to others whose understanding and faith are lagging behind mine? Okay. Here's some things we're not supposed to do, right? The big book cautions us against harboring resentments. That's an interesting word, harbor. It reminds me of a place where a ship can be safe in a storm. How do I make myself a safe harbor for resentments so that anger and hate feel comfortable living in me? Well, one way is to go over and over them in my mind and with others. So number eight, we are not to review our resentments over and over in our minds or over and over with others under the guise often of getting help or asking, can you just pray for this person who really needs prayer, when what we're really trying to do is get that other person to agree with our perception that that guy's really a louse. We're building our harbor. And the best thing is to tell one person, and ideally someone who doesn't know the person we resent. Like, I usually go over my resentments with Melissa, but if it's someone who she knows, I'll generally go to someone else instead who doesn't go to the same meetings we go to, or travel in the same circles, so that, you know, I don't get someone to say, oh yeah, I know that person. Yeah, they really are. Yeah, you're right to be angry. No, we don't do that. And also sometimes we call someone before we do a resentment inventory, saying that we just need to vent. That's not in the big book. And Tim Keller, one of my favorite spiritual authors, says that if we're angry with someone, we don't need to vent, we need to repent. So before we call each other to talk about our lousy husbands, you know, our annoying bosses, our undisciplined kids, we need to do our resentment inventory. If someone ever calls me and says, oh, I'm so mad at, you know, whatever, I'll say, yeah, do you have a resentment inventory? Call me back when you've got your resentment inventory. Number nine, we avoid retaliation and argument. The big book makes it clear that avoiding retaliation is an essential ingredient in the cocktail of forgiveness, right? When someone wrongs us, there is an absolutely unavoidable sense that the person owes us, like they've incurred a debt. And we want to make that person pay. We do that by hurting them back, by yelling at them, by ruining their reputation, by making them feel bad in some way, or if we feel ourselves spiritually above that, we just sit back and watch and wait and secretly hope that something bad happens to them. And then only after we see them suffer in some way do we feel that the debt's been paid. So what's forgiveness? Forgiveness means giving up the right to seek repayment from the one who harmed us. It means we give up the right to revenge, either here or in the hereafter. And I had an example of a relative who wasn't always very nice to me growing up. And I kept my mouth shut. I was kind, but most of the time. But I secretly had this thought that when this person died, God was going to get them. God was going to show them a movie of their life and all the things they'd done to hurt me, and that person would suffer. But as a person in recovery, I couldn't stay that way. So what I did is I said, God, anything that person did to me, don't hold it against them. Now, it took my emotions a while to catch up. For a while, it was like, you know, it was almost like, God, don't hold it against him. But in my heart, I really want you to. I couldn't change my emotions, but I could change my will. And ultimately, my emotions caught up. And finally, miraculously, it was like my memory was healed. Because now when I think of that person, I have to struggle to think of the bad things that were done to me. God cleaned my memories. Number 10, we ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. That means we don't vent at that person in order to feel better necessarily. Now, again, sometimes we have hard conversations, but it doesn't mean that we go and say, you did blah, 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 and start yelling at them. E. Stanley Jones talks about a woman who was very angry at her husband. And she said, I think I'd be well if I could just once tell my husband to go to hell. And his comment was, perhaps she would have been relieved momentarily, but the resentments would fill up again and be ready for another spillover. Expression is not the remedy. It's merely dealing with a symptom instead of the disease. So we have to have tolerance, compassion, and patience. Tolerance, like I love how Melissa put it, that it's my own threshold to withstand pain or sorrow is raised. So that means I stop being so easily offended. Pity, the feeling of sorrow and compassion at the suffering and misfortune of others. And patience, just realizing that God's going to heal people on his timetable. And that, you know, I used to, at one point, I had a boyfriend and the relationship was very tumultuous. And so I would pretend I was in that movie. I don't remember the name. It was that Jim Carrey movie where his whole life was like really a movie. If anyone knows it, stick it in the chat. And I would just think the Truman Show. Thank you, Haya. So I would just think everything that happens is just raw material for my relationship with God. It doesn't matter ultimately what happens with me and that person. It's what happens with me and God. So I want to close with my favorite story of, oh, forgiveness. But before I do, actually, I want to say a few things about forgiving ourselves. So sometimes people ask, should I put myself on a resentment inventory? And the big book is silent on it. I say no. And here's why. First, it's really awkward if I say I resent myself for whatever it is, and then to figure out what boxes to check. It's just like awkward. It doesn't really work. And then if I'm resentful at myself, it's probably because I've done something wrong. So if I've done something wrong, this program gives me a mechanism for that. I inventory, what did I do wrong? I admit it to another person. I ask God to remove it, remove the defects, and then I make my amends. Now, what if it's, I resent myself that, you know, I have this illness and I haven't done well? Then I would say, just recover. We just recover. We don't need to put ourselves on a resentment inventory. And then sometimes people say they have more trouble forgiving themselves than they do accepting God's forgiveness. But what really lies behind this idea of I can't forgive myself? So according to Tim Keller, again, my favorite, he says, when we say I can't forgive myself, it's really an indication of pride. Because we are in essence saying our judgment is more accurate than God's. When we say, I know God has forgiven me, but I just can't forgive myself, we're acting as if our own judgment holds more weight than God's. And the big book is clear, right? That anytime we're sorry for what we've done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven. And it says, we don't live with worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, you know, and too much regret for what we've done. Why? Because then we're not going to be useful to others. Why? Because we're just focused on public enemy number one, ourselves. So I just want to close with my favorite story of forgiveness, that Corrie Ten Boom. And she was a woman who, during World War II, she was a devout Christian woman, and she and her family hid Jews in their house in the Netherlands. And eventually they got caught and they all got sent to a concentration camp. And she watched her sister, who she was very close with, just die a horrible death there. So this is what she says. And so afterwards, and I believe she was the only one in her family who survived. And afterwards, she went around Europe talking about forgiveness. So this is what she says. It was in a church in Munich that I saw him, a balding, heavyset man in a gray overcoat, a brown felt hat clutched between his hands. People were filing out of the basement room where I had just spoken, moving along the rows of wooden chairs to the door at the rear. It was 1947, and I had come from Holland to defeated Germany with the message that God forgives. It was the truth they needed most to hear in that bitter, bombed out land, and I gave them my favorite mental picture. Maybe because the ocean is never far from a Hollander's mind, I like to think that that's where forgiven sins are thrown. When we confess our sins, I said, God cast them into the deepest ocean, gone forever. The solemn faces stared back at me, not quite daring to believe. There were never questions after a talk in Germany in 1947. People stood up in silence collected their coats, in silence left the room. And that's when I saw him, working his way forward against the others. One moment I saw the overcoat and the brown hat he was wearing. The next, a blue uniform and a visored cap with its skull and crossbones. It came back with a rush. The huge room with its harsh overhead lights, the pathetic pile of dresses and shoes in the center of the floor, the shame of walking naked past this man. I could see my sister's frail form ahead of me, ribs sticking out beneath her skin. Betsy, how thin you were. Betsy and I had been arrested for concealing Jews in our home during the Nazi occupation at Holland. This man had been a guard at Ravensbrück concentration camp where we were sent. Now he was in front of me, hand thrust out. A fine message, Fräulein. How good it is to know that, as you say, all our sins are at the bottom of the sea. And I, who had spoken so glibly of forgiveness, fumbled in my pocketbook rather than take that hand. He would not remember me, of course. How could he remember one prisoner among those thousands of women? But I remembered him and the leather crop swinging from his belt. It was the first time since my release I'd been face to face with one of my captors, and my blood seemed to freeze. You mentioned Ravensbrück in your talk, he was saying. I was a guard in there. No, he didn't remember me. But since that time, I found God. I know that God has forgiven me for the cruel things I did there, but I would like to hear it from your lips as well, Fräulein. And his hand came out. Will you forgive me? And I stood there, I whose sins had every day to be forgiven and could not. Betsy had died in that place. Could he erase her slow, terrible death simply for the asking? It could not have been many seconds that he stood there, hand held out. But to me, it seemed hours as I wrestled with the most difficult thing I had ever had to do. For I had to do it. I knew that. The message that God forgives has a prior condition, that we forgive those who've injured us. If you don't forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father in heaven forgive your trespasses. I knew it not only as a commandment of God, but as a daily experience. And yet I stood there with the coldness clutching my heart. But forgiveness is not an emotion. I knew that. Forgiveness is an act of the will, and the will can function regardless of the temperature of the heart. Jesus, help me, I prayed silently. I can lift my hand. I can do that much. You supply the feeling. And so woodenly, mechanically, I thrust my hand into the one stretched out to me. And as I did, an incredible thing took place. The current started in my shoulder, raced down my arm, sprang into our joined hands. And then this healing warmth seemed to flood my whole being, bringing tears to my eyes. I forgive you, brother, I cried, with all my heart. For a long moment, we grasped each other's hands, the former prison guard and the former prisoner. I had never known God's love so intensely as I did then.